همون چه در همش میده در همه همش برسن کن So I just feel grateful to have people here. Thanks for coming. Also folks online, but especially it's nice to see people. What I'd like to do here today is move towards... So there's a pattern that emerges, right, if we're watching our practice, that when we're caught, what's happening is that we're trying to arrange our environment, our internal environment as well as our external environment. And selfing, basically, you know, to make it a verb. And it's easy to constrict around that observation, right? It's easy to tighten up and try to shut off that activity, to dam that flow. And that is how not to do Zen, right? That is how to do Zen for a fairly short and generally unsatisfying time, which I don't recommend. But there's some subtlety to that, and so that's what I want to get into today. So we all are affected by beginningless karma. We all come to this... you know, with affinities in some directions and intolerances in others. And, you know, there's this mix of preferences. And when we're being pulled around by those preferences, when we're not really at choice, we describe that as being caught by small self. That's the basic teaching of Hyakujo's fox. This is the second koan in the Mumon Kan. It's not... that karma doesn't affect us, is that we're not deceived by it. So we're not confused about how karma affects us. When we're not confused, we have more options. And so even though there's that influence, you know, we're still touched by it, it doesn't compel us to follow its dictates, right? Practice isn't a get out of jail free card. It does give you more flexibility, more room for error. So the problem here is when we try to excise these aspects of small signs of expressions as opposed to others. Get it wrong and you're a fox for 500 years. Or you get rung out of sanzen, or 30 blows, or you're wasting your time in meditation, or whatever it may be. No one wants to be found out to be not worthy. So there's a tension. I remember one time I was chatting with this priest from another lineage, and we were talking about monastic practice, and you know, they were quizzing me about, you know, my life, my lifestyle. And at some point in the conversation, my appreciation for circus skills came up. And it was kind of a yellow flag for them. There was this kind of a quality of suspicion, like that didn't, it was discordant with their image of what a monastic lifestyle was. Which, you know, sure, you know, the Pali Canon has passages, you know, It has some Southern Baptist sections in there where it's like, you know, no dancing, no singing, you know, whatever, no music. That kind of stuff is unconducive to a meditative life. So that's fine. You know, other things that are unconducive to a meditative life are like traffic or using currency or living in an urban area or having physical ailments. Serving on the board. There's lots of possibilities, right? We could be here a long time if we filled out that list. And, you know, maybe they were on to something, some artifact from my past. The from, you know, the only time I seriously, like, considered the doubt piece, the only time after I was ordained that I seriously considered not being ordained was, you know, fairly soon thereafter. And there was like this 2 to 3 week window where there was a possibility of leaving and like joining a circus, going to circus school. So there was something there. And so in the conversation, like I explained that like, you know, this is inspiring, it's nourishing, it's it brings energy and delight. Shout out to the Wednesday class series right now. And those are both two of the seven factors of enlightenment for those who are following along. And, you know, they accused me of kind of a circular argument that I like it and therefore it's good for me. And, you know, I could conceivably apply that to all kinds of unwholesome but hedonistic activity. And, okay, sure. But there's also this, there's kind of a brittleness to that. There's kind of a clutching that closes off to life in the name of not making mistakes, not getting it wrong. And it misses some of the alchemy of the tradition. You know, hindrance is hindered by hindrance. Life is one continuous mistake. You know, those are, you know, those, that's from Dogen. So those are affirming statements from our tradition. In practice, we're not trying to just not make mistakes. We're trying to live this life as cleanly and profoundly as possible. Our root koan, like the core thing that we're dealing with throughout our practice career is our actual conditioning. You know, the beginningless karma that we inherit and our actual situation and the interaction thereof. We have to work really hard to learn from all the times we don't solve that koan, all the times we get wrung out of that sanzen, all our misexpressions of our insight. And that's how this path works. That's what keeps us moving forward. There's a saying, it's easy to be enlightened in a cave. And I actually had a conversation with someone, a nun who spent several years in a cave, and apparently it's not actually easy to be enlightened in a cave. Beside the point, but we have that saying. And what it's pointing to is a kind of state-specific learning where if we only practice under the easiest conditions, we can move really quickly within that very narrow range. But as soon as we depart from that range, it doesn't help us. We don't have the same access in more difficult situations. And it's why we sit and we also do work practice. Right? That back and forth. The deepening and then the broadening. That's why we start sesshin and then we also end it. We don't just keep going. Oftentimes, you know, people in the first couple of years of practice will finish a sesshin and they'll have this taste of like, wow, like there's so much that's, it's so right. That's exactly who I am. Like, why can't I just keep going? And, you know, because it's just a slice of who you actually are. Right, we need to integrate that into the rest of our life. There's a fullness that's needed. That's why we come to temple and we also go home to our families, to our jobs, to whatever it may be. So I don't think that in general, Dharma Rain, like the culture here, trends in the direction of that rigidity, right? Broadly. I think there are training venues that I've been in where that is the trend, that it does push in that direction. But it happens. You know, and even when it's, if it's not encouraged, like we can all catch ourselves tightening up around making mistakes, trying to repress the possibility there. So the root there is that we don't want to be fooled, right? We don't want our small self to lead us over a cliff while we're enjoying the view. But we also want to inhabit our given life with as much ease and freedom and creativity and discovery as feasible. And, you know, we also do make bad decisions. So we need to have some way or some ways of discerning whether a particular beautiful view is safe or whether we're avoiding looking at something really important. With mindfulness, we make choices about where we put our attention, how we behave, the manner in which we communicate with others. Hopefully, overall, those are movements towards what is wholesome and movements away from what is unwholesome. One of the mechanisms by which we do that is the basic question of, is there attachment or not? Attachment is the action of craving. And it could be either for something or against something. And attachment usually feels like some sensation of pressure or constriction or haste. Mentally, it feels more like it's about who I am, right? There's an identity piece which is activated with attachment. So we can check both physically and mentally. And that's not to say that you can't feel pressure mentally. I mean, so there's physical sensations thereof, but there's also that like mind sense of pressure or haste. So a lot of ways to catch it, but frequently those signifiers are going to be prominent with some mindfulness. So are they there? Do they show up when I notice my experience? If not, then we're probably not currently in the grip of coarse attachment. And it's more likely to be safe to move forward. So that's basic. It's a binary kind of on-off expedient sort of approach. I think it's essential that is a, you know, in our toolkit, and we can do that with some frequency, but it's not the whole story. Part of the deal there is that, you know, attachment can be transformed. You know, who we are changes. We mature. And we have to play it out some to get that leverage. So if we follow a rule like that, like don't move forward if there is attachment, if we follow that strictly and exclusively, you know, we don't get that chance and we never move towards something that might be pleasant. Another challenge there is that there's a near enemy to that kind of yes, no, on, off noting of attachment, and that some version of analysis, right? For many of us, that's kind of the go-to. Thinking through the possible outcomes, relying on our past conditioning to predict what's going to happen. And that kind of activity is, you know, tends to be dissociating, and it makes it harder to, the further we go down that road in a given instance, the harder it is to land the actual mindfulness we need to notice our momentary state. So far, so good? Okay. Another kind of weakness of that approach is that attachment is only one of the possible misses. Right? Another frequent miss is some version of denial, right? Repressing or suppressing our experience, in which case we might not feel that tightness, right? We might not feel that numbness or that vagueness. And for some people, that's primary. That's more what they move towards. So that basic wish to not be fooled, to see deeply into the situation, you know, can lead to wanting to squish the threat, you know, repression, or it can lead to us making it about who we are, you know, attachment. And both processes serve to reduce our level of awareness in the situation. Also, our acceptance, our ability to acknowledge what actually is. And with that, when we have less of that, our ability to move with it practically and also transform it alchemically is also reduced. Okay. People are getting the broad outlines here, and I'm feeling a nervousness arise that this is a little bit technical. Let me do a little bit of a rephrase of some of that. So there's an experience that shows up. You know, we hear a sound, right? So if we meet that with mindfulness, then there's kind of a clarity to that. And we can notice, oh, how am I affected there by that sound? Two other options that might happen are, one is, I hate that sound. Why is he doing that? It startled me, right? So there's the attachment piece. It's like, it somehow affected me in a negative way, and if he keeps doing it, it's going to drive me crazy, right? The story continues very easily. The other possibility is like, you know, like kind of numb out, kind of suppress the activation from that. So if we do either of those, we're losing touch with who we are in that moment, and there's less liveness. And that's what we're looking for in Zen. We're looking for that liveness, for that vividness in our relating to our experience. That's what we're showing in Sanzen. That's what's being expressed in like the koan stories. Okay. So if we can bring that awareness, that acceptance, that acknowledgement of what it's like to be us to our formations, to our thoughts, emotions, memories, the meaning we make of the world and how we situate ourselves in it, you know, that's basically mindfulness. And practicing that helps, you know, first off, not to be deceived by the small self. And it works by basically being hospitable, right? It's the opposite of that clamping down, of that opposite of like denying. Beginningless karma arises, it starts to push. We feel that pressure. And if we can respond with warmth, with curiosity, with like, oh yeah, I'm trying. Something different happens. Enough warmth over time, and that small self doesn't need to arise, right? The impetus doesn't show. That's why we want that vividness, right? We want to be able to it can be hard to land appreciation in a painful situation, right? If we're in a state of mindfulness, like we're not trying to change the painfulness of it. We're just trying to like, because it's more interesting, right? It pulls us in a intimate way, not in a getting tugged way. And so we have something to offer. We have an open heart. And that's what makes transformation work. That's the motor. That's the engine. Beginningless karma, our root delusion is that I am something separate, right? I am something continuous and limited and separate. Who I am is this particular form. Who I am is this particular consciousness. When that confusion doesn't arise, our formations are simpler. You know, the thoughts, emotions, memories, they don't seem to be fused together into a mass, right? Where that we can't separate out the pieces. We see the component pieces. Oh, my jaw is clenched. Oh, I'm thinking about how this person shouldn't be talking like that to me. Oh, the flush of blood in my face, right? You know, those are all separate events. It's very manageable. When it's just kind of all at once and I can't see through it, I'm caught. So that allowing our experience gives us more detail, gives us more clarity, and we can see how it comes apart into its pieces. All of these events make up our life, but they don't define our life. Right? Identity gets, with more awareness, identity gets broader, with less lines. So seeing that is difficult. But life wants to unfold. The universe wants to flow. We're part of and surrounded by amazing, surprising, awe-inspiring change, impermanence. When we touch this and we tighten up or stuff it down, it's a tragic strangling of life's offering. So most of us are, you know, relatively familiar with this within the context of meditation. It's the same. It's analogous. And in Zazen, in Shikantaza, which is just sitting, our basic practice is allowing exactly as it is. A physical sensation, a mental image, a little of storyline come through. A feeling tone arises, and they pass. If we see one and we try to make it go away, we're adding a thought to it. We're adding an intention to it. We're adding a formation to it, right? When I'm saying formation, that's from the Heart Sutra. That's one of the skandhas. One of the skandhas is the component parts of who we are. And it's a category for thoughts, emotions, memories, any kind of mental, object, basically. If we try to keep a thought from happening, that's adding a thought, adding an intent. If we try to bring our attention to the breath, that's substitution. It's a kind of a thought. It's something different from pure shikantaza. It's more steering than is absolutely necessary. It's enough to simply notice that we willed something in a subtle way and to release that particular moment of willing. It's a very densely packed series of micro surrenders. I kind of like that. That's a good one. I said, Shikantaza is a very densely packed series of micro surrenders. So if we can do that, if we can do Shikantaza in that way, it is very conducive to equanimity, to not being pulled or pushed by the content of our experience. And so we're much more available. It changes more naturally, which is usually quicker. So if there's a painful sensation or mind object, and we receive it with equanimity, it's going to change into something else. It's going to go away. That the suffering associated with it is going to lessen. And in a similar and kind of opposite way, if there's a pleasant sensation and we meet it with equanimity, it's also going to change. And that's going to be received, we're going to experience that as more pleasurable, typically. It becomes more vivid. There's more clarity about what that actually is. It deepens. It's thought which normally gums up the works, right? That's what prolongs instances of experience, as we run little loops that keep regenerating it. But if we don't add that energy to the equation, it just keeps changing. It's flex. If our attention is somewhat precise, we can notice that flow. We can notice that change. I mean, we can notice it in simple ways, like, you know, that's an example. The fact that you're hearing individual words, that's an example. If we notice that flow over time with enough steadiness, absorbing ourselves in that process of change, of arising and vanishing, we experience it actually as stillness, a deep stillness, which is quite nice. So it's the same for, so that's a little alleyway through Zazen there. So it's the same with deciding in managing our life and trying to decide what activities and what practices and what friendships and what media sources we're going to include in our life. We can move towards storyline and determine how it relates to us and be pushed and pulled by that quality of attachment of, craving or aversion. Or we can decide not to have that tension, that experience, and distract ourselves somehow. Or we can open towards equanimity. We can allow, like Shikantaza, and soften into what actually is. And for that to happen, we have to be okay with having a lot of misses. We have to be okay with being surprised. We have to, we're going to be embarrassed. We're going to be like a fool, like an idiot. But we'll also hit it just so now and then. Practicing more with more skill, practicing like your hair's on fire. It's more about having to do with how we integrate the lessons of those misses, of those experiences, not about only having positive ones. Zen is not inhibiting the flow of our experience. Please don't shackle yourself to a projection of how Zen should be. Find the real thing again and again. questions or comments, please.
And for the people on Zoom, if you have a question or comment, you can either type question or comment in the chat box and verbally say that over Zoom. If you would like me to read that for you, go ahead and type that in the chat box. And we will go back and forth between Zendo questions and Zoom questions. Ordinarily, I like dinner. So everyone can see and the speaker can see. I'm not going to do that today in case that's related to the Zoom dropping in the hall. So my apologies for the tech issues today, and we'll refrain from the spotlight aspect today.
Thanks, Anna.
Looks like we have a comment on Zoom from Jika. Jika, let me...
We'll get you after.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Hi. You just started to get to this at the end, and I really make a connection between what you were saying at the beginning about people who really move toward that rigidity and that inflexibility around discipline and the fear of making a mistake. And I've seen teachers who it seems like the focus of their practice is to avoid mistakes, and that means there's no sense of naturalness or spontaneity in their practice. So I guess this is mostly a comment. I don't know if you have any more to say about that, but we can really be so careful that we miss that completely.
Yeah. I mean, I got really stuck with this. I came in with my own tendency and how it bounced off Zen led to a lot of contraction in practice. And it was really, Kyogen was really useful around that because he was not like that to a significant degree. And he really partly it was just his example of being not irreverent, but like natural, I guess. And pretty like, you know, his own variety. You know, he had a very particular flavor, and it was a little silly, a little bit goofy, and he was completely at home with that. And so that was important. And the other thing was that he made it real clear to me over time, explicitly, you know, this is one of the nails that he just beat on, is that if we're too careful, people can't use it as an example. And, you know, we're here trying to be bodhisattvas. We're here trying to be helpful. And if people can't see us learning from our mistakes, like it doesn't work. There's no traction.
Right. Well, and it's not just that he made mistakes. We saw him make mistakes. I saw him get embarrassed and angry about his mistakes, and I saw him recover from that. And that was as important as anything to me was, yeah. Oh yeah, he gets angry. Oh yeah, he feels embarrassed and he's still okay. And so I can be embarrassed and I can be okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
We have one in the Zendo.
Hey, is this working? Yeah? Okay. So I'm curious about, I suppose how like the small self relates to setting boundaries. Because when I heard you speaking kind of sort of in the middle, it sounded like, you know, that any time one were to set a boundary, it would be relating to the small self. And then I was like, oh, like, then how does that work? Does that kind of make sense? Can you speak to that?
Well, I think it might depend on whether you're talking about setting boundaries with yourself.
No, for other people.
Yeah, I'm not sure that relates to it. I think you could do that in a real wholesome way. That's not like being pushed around by a small self. Am I misunderstanding the question?
No, I think you're right. I'm just curious, like, how, I guess?
Ah.
Like, what's, like, the thought behind that?
Sure, okay.
Like, I'm missing the connection.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, like, just going into mindfulness, you know, like, micro here. If, you know, if someone's asking something from me and it's not okay, when I hear that, there's going to be a physical response to that. And so if this is the first time this is happening, like we're getting our bearings, we're figuring it out. But if we've watched this over time, we get to notice like, oh, if I'm feeling that, like, then something is happening which I might be being taken advantage of or something. Like there's something that's like, it's not going to be okay for me long term. And, you know, so you can use that clue of like, oh, okay, now I need to like change the situation. I need to do something different here.
Is that feeling not just attachment though? Is it separate?
Yeah. It's, so it could go either way, right? There can be this like, so someone could say like, hey, Kakumyo, like, I want you to mow my lawn every week for the summer. And I'm like, oof, like there's a lot going on. I don't know if I can do that. And so I could be pretty simple about it if I caught it right away and be like, gosh, like my life is full. I don't have time to do that. Sorry. I don't feel any residue saying that. You know, that feels really straightforward and simple. Or I could go towards like, ooh, I gotta find it. I really don't want to make this person like, you know, mad or not like me. And but I'm also like, I gotta take care of these things over here. And so I'm feeling like torn. I'm feeling like there's different things pulling me in different directions. And my mental state is suddenly complicated and there's pressure and that's attachment. That's me. Like I want it to be a certain way and it's not like this. Whereas in the first one, like I'm okay with it being exactly like this. And actually like I'm not going to follow that particular path of behavior that was just offered to me, but I'm not challenging the situation as it is. It's okay as it is. This person wants me to do something. I'm not going to do it. Okay, that's life.
So like the feeling and response to what? Okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You have a question on Zoom? This is from Aiko. I often think I could have really gotten somewhere with this if I'd applied myself in the last 10 years. Look where some of the peers I came in with have gotten to, unquote. Of course, I haven't failed utterly to practice, but when I measure, which I never seem to be able to stop doing, I am disappointed in myself. This, in turn, is a kind of self-defeated thinking. What is my fundamental error?
That's a rich question. Thanks, Seiko. Let me just land that for a moment. I would say that I'm less interested in the fundamental error and I'm more interested in the fundamental answer. And that has to do with like caring about this as it is, like finding that way to feel your heart open towards your life exactly as it is. And like the off ramp there, the way to not do that is to, like, as you hold that possibility, to give yourself reasons why you can't do it, or you don't want to do it, or why it doesn't actually measure up. And know that that fundamentally that's chaff. That's just stuff. And it's not actually in the way of your heart opening in a moment. Of course, we have to repeat that again and again and again and again, but you can get one good moment out of it. Got another in the Zendo, it looks like.
Hello, this is Yutong. Thank you for your talk, Kakumyo. I'm wondering about liveness when you kind of up the intensity. So for example, in residence, we were talking about firefighting the other day, and I was thinking about we've consistently been having fires in the Pacific Northwest in late summer, around September. So thinking about what that feels like to be kind of engulfed in smoke, and thinking about the people who are right there next to the flames. What does non-attachment look like there, right? Like, what does, could you describe what it might feel like, or what it might look like?
So I might be reading into your question a little bit, so tell me if I am. But I think what you're getting at is, often when we're thinking about equanimity, and especially like a kind of profound degree of equanimity, we associate that with being still, with being tranquil, with being, at ease. And that seems different from what a firefighter might be doing, for example. And so there's, one of the near enemies of equanimity is basically pulling back, is a kind of apathy where we're not engaging. And so I think that's part of it, but part of it is just like, that's close. And so, we're seeing some of that when we're looking at this broad territory. But the other part, my guess is that, find the words here. I think there's a wishing that equanimity, when we're in a state of some distress, some level of distress, we want equanimity to fix that, and we want that kind of settling. But to actually hit equanimity, we have to be really open. And it might be more intense. And the equanimity that we care about is the okayness with that, regardless of whether it's more intense or not. And I feel like that's a learned, that trust is learned over a long time, that we see by just doing it, again and again and again, that when I allow my experience to get very close to me, I survive. It's okay. I get through that. And it may be intense. It may be destabilizing. It may be, all kinds of stuff, confusing and whatnot. But there's also kind of a cleanness to it after the fact. I don't think equanimity makes it harder for us to deal with stuff. I think, that's part of the back and forth between compassion and equanimity. There's a important relationship there.
You're reminding me a bit of, I've heard saying yes to no. So going back to an example, fighting fires, mm-hmm. but maybe it's kind of acknowledging that you don't want the fire to be there, but also saying, yes, the fire is here, and yes, I'm doing something about it.
Yeah.
But just not, yeah, holding that open, rather than just attaching to the no, mm-hmm. maybe.
Equanimity gets kind of proofed. It gets refined. There's a metallurgical term for that. Anyway, whatever. It gets stronger by like continually being challenged to adapt to more difficult situations. And compassion is what keeps us going into more difficult situations. So, yeah, we see the forest burning, like something's needed. Can we bring equanimity to that?
Thank you.
Question on Zoom from Sozetsu. Oh, sorry, Sozetsu, I need to unmute you. Just a second here.
Thank you, Kakumiya. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. I like this micro surrenders process. Thinking about the micro surrenders process, I've kind of thought maybe I've had a hard time with a couple things. And so in the initial kind of noticing of something coming up and the grabbiness or attachment, but then putting a lot of focus on that process and then sometimes not really putting mindfulness on when the absence of it is there, or when it ceases, or when it lets go, and some really honor that as an important practice. And I really haven't done so much of that. And the second part, I guess if there's a kind of micro surrender, I sometimes feel like there's a micro orientation in underneath, which is a self-oriented, like I'm practicing for myself. It's like for my next better emotional state or for some ulterior. And I feel it underneath. It's not like it's a thought in my head. And I'm in this whole bodhisattva notion of practicing for all beings, together with all beings. And I know by practicing for my, you know, just doing zazen, is for self and other, but I guess I'm just opening those two open,
yeah,
as part of the process, or and asking what your thoughts are.
Great, yeah, I'm glad you brought that in here. I think that's part of the art of doing this, like in an actual life, like over time, that you know, there's the you know Shikan Taza style practices which are very open. And, you know, not adding anything to it. And then there's also tons of practices that are quite active, quite targeted, quite specific, cultivating particular states, precepts, you know, for instance. And both are needed, right? If we're only doing one type of practice, it's going to, you know, there's going to be an imbalance there. And so I think there's this part of what we're learning in practice is like, okay, like when do I need to go to this well? When do I need to go to that well? How do I combine that in a you know skillful way throughout my life? But both are definitely part of it. And don't feel like you're you know like cheating Shikan Taza if you're adding a little metta in because you're really frustrated at your boss or something like that. Like, you know, like that may be really important. Like that's a specific tool. It gives you a lot of leverage. Use that. That's great. I think we have time for one more. We're right up against it. So we've got one in the Zendo.
I was thinking of a moment this last week that I was able to kind of use as you're giving your talk, which was helpful. And I'm curious about that. the moment of making a mistake and realizing the mistake, and then kind of what comes after that, and like I can, and like getting caught in that like is very easy, but like I had an experience where I definitely was caught in it, but also like rather than turning away from that pain of that, like like you're saying, being curious about it and inhabiting it, but sometimes that inhabiting of it can also feel like getting stuck, and I'm kind of curious. Like,
yeah. So what I'm hearing is there's kind of a slippery line in between really like kind of allowing the experience to kind of deepen and evolve a little bit so that you're really bringing a quality of mindfulness and investigation to it versus starting to perseverate, starting to like process, starting to analyze and just bringing your karma to it. Yeah, I think that's true. I think what I would do there is check and see if you just like stop for a moment, is there momentum? You know, like if you have a hard-boiled egg and you spin it and you stop it, how that's different from a raw egg. Same thing here. So there's some flow of association through you, and that could be association from, you know, just kind of processing. It could be association from like, oh, I'm noticing like this clenching in my heart, and also there's this queasiness in the belly. And, you know, so either way, but if you stop one of them, it's still. And if you stop the other, there's, you want to keep going. So try that out and see if that helps you discern there. All right. So we are at time. Thanks for being here and giving your attention. Have a great day.